Welcome to OU's Torah Timachanach Yomi. My name is Liat Meyerfeld, and I'm going to attempt to recap the storyline and messages in the book of Melachim Aleph. Imagine having prophecy. I'd love God to describe the future, telling me what to do, when, and how. Not having to debate, wonder, and second guess would make life so much easier. Yirmiyahu takes on the monumental task of describing the events leading up to the destruction of the first temple. His prophecy doesn't give us exact instructions how to fix it. Oh, I wish it would, but then life wouldn't be life. What this prophecy does teach all generations about the deep struggles of the kings and the people, the choices that brought the nation to its knees, and tools to hopefully stay connected to Hashem and ultimately rebuild from the ashes. We first learn about the experience of the high of what the Jewish people ideally could be. Chapters 1 through 11 describe the rise of King Shlomo's kingship, the building of the first temple, and the superpower that the nation of Israel became, a light unto the nations. Chapter 1 starts by introducing the dynamic, God-centered King David as non-functioning, paralyzed physically and spiritually. In a stunning political move, his son Adoniah announced a search for a young maiden to lie with David and warm him. This national beauty contest announces loud and clear that David, forever cold, is dying, and with pretend concern, a new one must be crowned urgently. How convenient for Adoniah, who crowns himself as the heir. King David's failure to maintain body heat comes as repercussion for his cutting King Shaul's cloak. Coupled with his behavior with Bathsheba, David is devastated by his sins and resigned to suffer personal calamities. Our chapter clearly teaches that even the greatest king is not immune to consequences for his actions, and tshuva is the only key to moving forward and clearing the past. Bathsheba comes to King David to remind him of his promise to crown her son Shlomo. When David honors his oath to Bathsheba, he affirms that tshuva has been done, and with much pomp and circumstance, Shlomo is anointed as king. Adoniah's supporters panic, and Adoniah himself seeks sanctuary at the altar. King Shlomo agrees to spare his life if Adoniah is loyal to him. King David commands Shlomo for his future, first his spiritual legacy. Be strong in knowing that as long as you follow his ways and stay true to him, Hashem will be with you, and together you will be the strongest alliance. Then the physical legacy with a practical political message instructing Shlomo to be responsible for people who have harmed or helped David during his reign. King David dies, and Shlomo continues as a king anointed by God. With all of David's loose ends tied up nicely in chapter 2, Shlomo can start his reign with a clean slate and in peace with a spiritual focus. Life moves fast, and we get caught up in it. Sometimes you look back and you think, wow, how did I get here? And sometimes you can look back and say, it all started here. Unfortunately, together with Shlomo's rise to great spiritual heights, we also look back and see that the destruction starts here, in chapter 3. For political and military considerations, King Shlomo married Pharaoh's daughter. She must have also been utterly fabulous, because the slide downhill starts when Shlomo allowed her and his other foreign wives to worship idols. Meanwhile, in other news, Shlomo loves Hashem. He brings hundreds of sacrifices and prays for connection. When given an open check, Shlomo famously does not ask for an offshore savings account, a Cybertruck, flawless skin, or for the Phillies to win the World Series, but rather lev shomea, an understanding to recognize good from bad. Hashem gushes in praise for Shlomo's altruistic request. King Shlomo has shown his potential to be a great leader, and we are told he's often put to the test, here with the famous court case of two women fighting over one baby. Shlomo's suggestion to cut the baby in half points to the real mother, teaching us that a parent's focus on the physical and spiritual well-being of a child is paramount. Yirmiyahu describes Shlomo and his court so idyllically that we can start to understand the grandeur and greatness of his kingship. The success of any empire depends on effective government, so chapter 4 gives us technical details of Shlomo building a solid team of people working for him and an administrative framework that aims to uphold the moral values of the Torah consistently. As a society, we need systems for safety, prosperity, and justice to ensure consistent access to sustenance, fulfillment, and happiness. As individuals, we dream of a system where we can get 5-minute meditations looking into an empty laundry basket with everything washed, dried, hung, and put away. Just 5 minutes. The people's identity is being changed from a religious tribal one to a national economic one. Shlomo wants everyone to dream big. Bureaucracy is working, life is orderly and prosperous. This is what the people originally wanted, and everyone sinks into the rigors of daily living. Ultimately, only thinking big fails as individuals don't feel cared for and lose focus of their godliness. Chapter 5 has Shlomo's dinner posts go viral, and he has millions of followers around the world. One of the most effective influencers, he makes sure everyone knows of his wealth and his wisdom. Shlomo's genius lies in his plan to harness all worldly knowledge and make Yerushalayim the hub of all wisdom, be it scientific, artistic, technological, or intellectual. He aims to create an epicenter, replacing conflict with the wisdom of Hashem. In an attempt to expand, Shlomo goes in deeper than he can swim, collaborating with Hiram, king of Tzur. He brings in foreign expertise, but he pays for it dearly with extreme financial commitments, essentially enslaving his own people to working for months on end, and perhaps even giving Hiram some of the land of Israel. The land for peace concept fails then already. Shlomo learns the hard way that we cannot rely on the nations. We have to know our true power, our spiritual power, which will bring physical power. The true utopian Jewish people is a people that isn't dependent on the nations of the world, but relies completely on Hashem. The temple is being built. Chapter 6 provides the technical specifications of the temple structure, its dimensions, the raw materials from which it was made, and even the form of the decorations with which it was decorated. The description shows us the love with which it was all built, and we get swept up in the excitement of the entrance hall, the large heichal, the space prepared for the ark and its kruvim. The magical Shamir cuts large stones for the huge edifice and delicate gemstones for the Kohen's breastplate. And suddenly, in the most intense moment, Hashem asks Shlomo, "Do you love me? Do you really mean it? You're building a physical temple I didn't ask for. What are you trying to accomplish?" The word Kadosh, holy, isn't mentioned even once. A temple is only worthwhile if it reflects Hashem's will. Chapter 7. The description of the workers and the building are practically identical to Bezalel and building of the Mishkan in the desert. In the Mishkan, Hashem dwells amongst the people, while Shlomo mainly builds a house for Hashem's presence to be contained. This house of Hashem is sensually overwhelming. Bronze and copper, swirls of pomegranates and flowers, animals and flowing water. Fabulous! Can these materials be filled with spirituality? If yes, then Shlomo has created heaven on earth. If the people can bring it to life, then it will be like the Garden of Eden. Chapter 8 brings us the pivotal day in Jewish history where King Shlomo brought the Ark into the temple, and Hashem's presence fills it. Shlomo is not only establishing himself as a political leader, but also as a religious and spiritual one. This chapter is practically a reenactment of the experience of the Ark of Hashem in the Mishkan in the desert. King Shlomo expresses a deep prayer that Hashem stay amongst the people and begs the nation to pray only to Hashem, with a temple as a conduit for our prayers to go beyond the physical place and focus on the spiritual. The celebration lasts through Yom Kippur and Sukkot, showing that Hashem had forgiven their sins and was present with them, a reason for extreme joy. With the temple built, Shlomo receives his Lifetime Achievement Award, a second revelation from Hashem. Just as Hashem had spoken to him as he was starting the building, so too now in chapter 9. Hashem promises to be unconditionally always present in the holy Yerushalayim. Then Hashem explains the parameters of two relationships. With Shlomo, if he and his descendants follow Hashem, King David's dynasty will always rule. And between God and the people, this relationship is eternal, as promised at Mount Sinai. But independent living in the land of Israel is dependent on our showing faithfulness. The chesed of the land of Israel must be earned by every generation not putting their faith in falsehoods. But for now, here in this chapter, Shlomo establishes Israel as a political and financial force, a collab with Hiram in the north to control the seas and with Pharaoh in the south to establish land trade. This comes hand in hand with King Shlomo bringing sacrifices to Hashem, recognizing the religious aspect of his reign as well. The Queen of Sheba comes to see King Shlomo's God-focused wealth and wisdom in chapter 10. His ability to answer the queen's four riddles is indicative of his wisdom and understanding of gender and sexuality and the deep spiritual nature of individuals and relationships. She brings with her wealth in order to also establish an economic alliance. Compared to King Hiram, she brings perfume and spices, obviously something alluring, and she develops an intimate relationship with Shlomo, so he ultimately commits to trade agreements with her, and we hear no more about ocean commerce with Hiram. The new trade agreements with Africa have been decided, and great wealth is amassed. Ultimately, the Queen of Sheba is not impressed by anything external. She knows the godly secret, and the queen says to King Shlomo, "God has established you as king to do justice and righteousness." The true greatness of King Shlomo is his own drive to do what is right with all of his godly gifts. Such commitment is a tool available to us all to motivate our own growth and permeate everything we do. And it's that commitment that can truly earn the respect of others and give us pride in ourselves. Chapter 11 brings us to the end of King Shlomo's reign. And the end, it doesn't look good. To the unimaginable amount of gold and the huge powerful chariot fleet, this chapter ends with the legendary number of wives, 1,000 wives. Money, horses, and wives, the three things a king is commanded to be wary of. Shlomo believed that his wealth and power would impress the world and they would take Hashem as their God. But Hashem's glory is meant to be appreciated in its purest form. And we see that the nations, and especially Shlomo's many wives, are not drawn to Torah, and idol worship persists. Shlomo's wealth, alliances, and political marriages become a stumbling block for the king and the people. When the people and their leader forgot to dream together, grow together, and build together, they were by definition already divided. So too today. Two external enemies are the political and practical translation of the divine anger against the holy King Shlomo for losing focus, and the internal enemy, Yeravam, who causes the greatest schism in the Jewish people. Yeravam rebukes Shlomo for mistreating the people and is in essence saying what Hashem knows King Shlomo needs to hear. And Yeravam is told that the kingdom will be split with Hashem choosing him to be king over Israel. He is also warned to stay in the straight path, and Hashem will build his house as he built King David's. King Shlomo dies, and while he might have erred in certain matters, his heart is always in the right place. He is the only king who is described as loving Hashem, and indeed his love for Hashem is unparalleled. The next few chapters will describe to us the establishment of a divided Israel. Chapter 12 has Rehoboam takes over from his father, but he's not as wise at all, and when he raises taxes, the people rebel and the kingdom is split. Perhaps Rehoboam's taxes were to keep the nation's focus on Yerushalayim, and we see that Yeravam is worried about that too, but in the opposite way. Yeravam is a skilled leader, and in order to keep the people connected to him and to the new kingdom in the north, he builds two golden calves. Okay, ironic, but his intention was for people to focus on the godly throne in heaven without having to go to Yerushalayim. He chooses Beit El to show that he is the successor of Yaakov and his sons, and creates a new calendar to further show the separateness of his kingdom. Yeravam possibly starts his kingdom with altruistic desires of creating a better world for his people, but his selfish desires for power, his fear of the people worshiping without him, his rush for power and control take over and become self-worship. We start chapter 13 with an Ish Elokim, a man of God, visiting from Yerushalayim. He goes to Beit El to admonish Yeravam. The man of God sees the king in an act of worship on the altar instead of a priest. Here we have a king that breaks through all the boundaries, controls everything. The man of God speaks to the altar itself. Altar, altar, he calls out, and he foretells of the future destruction of the altars and those that bring sacrifices on them. Yeravam responds to this man of God, "This is my temple." As he dramatically sends out his hand, we are told, "Vativash yado." Even more dramatically, his hand withers or becomes hard as stone. This is a point in Yeravam's life where he realizes he's crossed the line and uprooted himself from God. And this prophet tells him, "It's over." Yeravam tries to bring back peace and offers to buy the prophet lunch, but the Ish Elokim swipes left. Yeravam realizes he's been served divorce papers from Hashem, yet he ignores the warning, continuing his evil ways and appointing more fake priests to worship on the altars. In chapter 14, King Yeravam's son is deathly ill, so his wife dresses up to go ask Ahiah the prophet what will be, and to ask for prayers. Ahiah, of course, recognizes her and tells her that because of Yeravam's evil ways, this son will die and all of his family will be destroyed. The Jewish people will also suffer consequences and be exiled and degraded, but for the people there is hope and eternity. Indeed, the son dies and Yeravam dies. In Judean news, Rehoboam battles against Shishak, king of Egypt. When Shishak reaches Yerushalayim, in order to appease him, Rehoboam gives him the treasures from the temple and from his palace, and Shishak returns back to Egypt. Chapter 15, next king in Yerushalayim is the wicked Ahiah, but his son Asa destroys his parents and his evil grandmother's idol worship. We get mixed messages about Asa, though, because he is punished with a foot ailment. Asa shows lack of faith when he pays the northern nation of Aram to attack Baasha, then king of the northern kingdom. The civil war between the northern and southern kingdoms of Israel is devastating. The last third of Melachim Aleph focuses on the northern kingdom and Eliyahu, the prophet's mission. Chapter 16 describes the quick succession of wicked kings of the north, and Ahav comes to power. He marries the wicked Izebel, and she brings in idol worship of many kinds. Every day, vast money is donated to idols. The idolatrous priests are part of the government, and worshippers of God are tracked down and killed. We're also told about Chiel's attempt to build Jericho, and how the curse comes true and all his sons die. One message is that even when things fall apart before our eyes, we're often too blinded by our desires, and we don't see God's truth. Eliyahu the prophet bursts onto the scene in a storm in chapter 17, and he will stay with us till the end of time. Without unnecessary introductions, he informs King Ahav, "I swear in the name of Hashem whom I serve, there will be no more rain or dew except by my word." This comes as a reaction to Ahav's words at Chiel's son Shiva, where Ahav ostensibly denies Hashem and sees himself controlling the world. Well, let's see how that goes for you, Ahav. Eliyahu stopping the rain is meant to show the people that though they think their idol worship brings wealth and serenity, well, it's just not true. but the truth of Hashem is worth fighting for, and fight Eliyahu will. Hashem goes along with Eliyahu's curse about rain, but dew still falls because Hashem's love, well, it's soft and eternal as dew, caressing the earth every morning. Eliyahu has to escape and finds himself in the Vadi of Crete, being fed miraculously by ravens. When his personal river dries up, Eliyahu is ready to leave solitude and is sent to be taken care of by a widow in the north. She curses him for his expectations, which she is devastated that she can't provide. He miraculously fills her vessels with flour and oil, promising they will never run out. Through this widow, Eliyahu learns Hashem's way of accepting others and inviting them into your world. Together we are in Hashem's world, given as a kindness to us. As long as I acknowledge that none of it is mine, I can ask Hashem to use it all. I expand my reality to recognize Hashem and include others. The widow's son dies and is brought to life by Eliyahu. It is then that the widow tells Eliyahu he's graduated and is ready to take on Ahav and win back the hearts of the people. Chapter 18, it's time for Eliyahu to give back the keys of rain to Hashem. But before the rain comes, Eliyahu challenges the Baal priests to a worship duel. Whoever is God answers their prayers wins, and then the people will finally have to choose. The reality check is set up on Mount Carmel, and despite all the Baal priest's rituals and attempted cheating, the unavailable Baal does not respond. Eliyahu is cool, calm, and collected as he calls to Hashem. Fire comes down from heaven and accepts his offering. Hashem hu Elohim! The people are literally floored and yell out, accepting God as the one and only God. Eliyahu kills the Baal prophets and prays for Hashem to show himself to Ahav and bring the rain. It pours as Ahav rushes back to his palace. In chapter 19, his wife Izebel seems to be less than impressed, but her anger betrays her heart, and perhaps we see in Izebel's reaction a bit of a freakout at Eliyahu and his godly powers. She is clear that the people's inspiration was fleeting, and that they will come back to Mama Izebel and her idols, and she threatens Eliyahu. Eliyahu gives up, literally, but his death wish is denied. He retreats to Mount Sinai to remind Hashem that the relationship is based on Torah, which the people abandoned. Hashem wins this poker hand when he reminds Eliyahu that the relationship is eternal no matter what. Eliyahu would like a world of complete judgment. When it seems that wicked prosper while the righteous suffer, we also think we want that. But I, for one, am quick to realize that my existence would be very short-lived if I only had my own merits to stand on. Eliyahu's quest for fairness misses the meaning of Hashem's oneness, that in every absolute wrong there is at least a little bit of right too. We're about the complexities of life, not the absolutes, because in this way we can better hold on to that oneness. To be zealous for God was also be zealous for his people. Hashem has been trying to teach Eliyahu this leadership model. A prophet must hear not one imperative but two, guidance and compassion, both the love of truth and an abiding solidarity with those for whom the truth has become eclipsed, to hold the people together as one because Hashem is one. Eliyahu will forever bear witness to the relationship of the Jewish people and Hashem at circumcisions and Pesach Seders, two life cycle events that are forever part of the Jewish psyche and our connection to Hashem. But in this world, his role is almost over. Eliyahu goes to find Elisha, who will be the best prophet to attempt to connect the people to Hashem, this time with compassion and kindness. Chapter 20 takes us back to Ahav's kingdom. He's at battle with the axis of evil, many, many kingdoms who gathered together under Aram to fight against Israel. Ahav is at his lowest point, ready to concede. When pushed up against the proverbial wall, he finally stands up for his people. He holds his sefer Torah dear and knows that the Jewish people must continue to fight for their survival and the survival of moral and spiritual conscience of the world. He turns to a prophet who gives him instructions from Hashem how to win the battle. Miraculously, Aram and their squad retreat. There is a second battle where again Ahav is miraculously victorious despite his spiritual depravity. Here, in an insane plot twist, instead of taking complete control in victory, Ahav reaches out to his brother, Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, and allows him to go home in peace, instead of pieces, as my sons would say. Hashem is furious. This is my world. Ben-Hadad was brought into this battlefield so that you would overcome him. He was my prisoner, not yours to release. Ahav, who do you think you are to decide the strategy that you need him for a trade agreement? Are you the lord of the land? You've crossed the boundary thinking you are in control. So after all the hourly successful battles, Ahav returns home to Shomron disheartened and angry, perhaps only at himself. Chapter 21 brings a new low. Bet you can't say Navot's vineyard without a deep sigh. Oy, a petulant Ahav decides he needs it, and the wicked Izebel has Navot killed for rebellion he never instigated. Ahav wins the land and plants a vegetable patch. One cruelty has led to another, a spiral of sins. Ahav knows human nature. One small desire, a fleeting moment of wanting something, can bring even the greatest person down. It brought him down, but he doesn't see that. All he sees is that if he plants seeds of idol worship, they will quickly grow in every garden, and his idolatrous power can bring the people down. Jezebel is shown as heartless, but ultimately Ahab is responsible for Naboth's vineyard. Eliyahu informs Ahab that he is being punished for his addiction to acting in evil ways. He has sold his soul. Ahab hears Eliyahu's rebuke, and there's an incredible moment. Ahab rips his clothing and wraps himself in sackcloth. Dejected, Ahab surrenders before Hashem. Hashem believes him. This is serious tshuva, which Hashem takes at face value and changes his death decree. And we end with chapter 22. Yehoshaphat, king of Yehuda, attempts to connect with Ahab and the north. Ahab decides to use the Jewish unity to fight the final battle against Ben-Hadad, king of Aram. Time to finish the score. Yehoshaphat is up for it if Hashem says it's okay. Ahab's false prophets think it's a fab idea, but Yehoshaphat is not convinced. Doesn't Ahab have even one person in his country who can speak truth? One prophet is found and rushed to the palace. He prophesizes that the people will return home without their leader. This gets him thrown in jail, and Ahab and Yehoshaphat go to battle together against Aram. Ahab is killed, but dies supporting his people. Yehoshaphat goes back to Jerusalem and reigns for many years with much godliness in his kingdom. But even that good will come to an eventual bitter end. The downward spiritual spiral is spinning more and more wildly in both the northern and southern kingdoms. Thank you for studying together, Lilui Nishmot Imoteinu Ekarot, Esther Oppenheimer Aleha Shalom, and Sarah Schenker Aleha Shalom, each deeply devoted and proud to transmit their family's Torah legacy to the next generations.